Blog Talk Radio.
JH Experience with co-host Dolly Miller Brennan.
Produced by CommunicationCreations.com.
And now your host, the notorious MJH.
Happy Friday. Yes, the weekend is here, and I didn't know this was a holiday weekend. And we just had New Year's, and all of a sudden we got another three-day weekend coming up. I guess a lot of people are happy about that, but it kind of caught me off guard. So tonight we have Liberty Crusade with Larry Ballard. Our co-host Dolly Miller Brennan should be joining us here shortly at any time now. Larry Ballard, how are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing good, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing great. I have no idea what tonight's topic is. Do you have any idea? Because nobody told me.
Well, I guess what we'll do is I'll play Dolly's role and mine until she gets on the line. How's that?
Okay, but don't stick any cracks up your butt.
All right, I won't. Basically, what we were going to talk about tonight. What we were going to talk about tonight is something we've actually talked about before, but we really didn't cover it in detail. It was one of those segments where we kind of ran out of time. So with what's going on, I kind of wanted to go back and talk about the general topic of what's happening to this country. Are we collapsing, and if so, why? And then stages into something that's very, very important, and that is what can we do about it? As I've talked to people, I had a conversation earlier this week with a lady who had a lot of the facts and understood that we were in trouble, but she was standing there in a quandary because she said, I feel powerless. There's really nothing I feel like I can do. So what I thought we'd do is try to bring the listening audience up to where she was first, where they understand what's wrong, and then we can talk about what it is that we can try to do to help, you know, turn the tide and change things. So basically, the four things that I wanted to talk about to set the stage were about our values, the American value system, our national pride and what's happened to it, how it's been degraded, the way in which the government has divided us and turned us into fractionalized splinter groups, and then how they've made us dependent on them. And I was hoping Dolly was going to be here to fire questions at me so it could be more conversational, but here goes, and we'll see what happens. So, Mike, if you want to chime in. Do you want to do that real quick?
Yeah, let me try dialing her. You can either keep on talking or I can play some music, however you want
to
do it.
All right, I'll keep on talking and you try to get a hold of her. So I guess I'm talking to the listening audience by myself here then. So basically what I want to do is...
I'm still here, sir, but...
Well, but you're going to be calling her, so I'll be on my own.
I have confidence you can do it. A lot of people can't do it. Actually, a lot of people listening right now, not right now because you're listening to us, but just talking to the phone for 60 seconds and, you know, just like fill up air for 30 seconds. People don't realize how hard that is to do.
Well, try doing it for an hour, which is what we're going to do tonight. Well, anyway, trying to get on topic and trying to make this mean something to the public.
It's a talent. It really is a talent.
Well, whatever it is. Anyway, basically, let's try to talk about our value system and see if we can get some understanding as to what's happened. We were a nation that was founded on Christian beliefs, and now we've got a president that says we're not a Christian society. We used to have Pledge of Allegiance in the school systems. We no longer have it. We used to pray in the schools. We no longer have it. The Muslims who have private schools that are not funded by the government study the Quran every single solitary day. So the net of it all is that our religious beliefs have been undermined. When you go to the churches, this is something that happened to me a couple of months ago. I went to a church, and they were having a speaker on this topic, actually. It was the pastor of the church who was speaking on the topic that I've written my book on, which is the fight for freedom. It's all about our political degradation of our system.
I'm sorry.
And he made
the person you called has a voicemail box that has not been set up yet. Goodbye.
Hello, are we still there?
Yeah, we're still here. I was trying to call Dolly, but she's not answering her phone.
Okay. All right, so basically what happened is because the churches all receive, this is the problem, they give us money. The federal government gives us money, and any time they get money attached to anything, they control it. And so what happens is these our churches have been allowed to be degraded in terms of what they can say from the pulpit because the pastors are absolutely mortified that if they get involved in the political arena and it looks like they're endorsing a candidate or a particular political party that they'll lose their tax exemptions. So on this particular night, the pastor comes up in front of the group and says, if anybody has any recording devices, put them away, turn your cell phones off, put your notepads down, there'll be no note-taking. There normally is a telecast, they videotape, there was no videotaping. So in other words, he was willing to give the congregation the message because the congregation had been asking for it, but he was not willing to have it on record because of fear of the government. So the first thing that's happened in terms of our values is that we've lost our Christian heritage has been greatly, greatly undermined. And with that comes the next problem. They're now driving us, now that they're degrading our Christian values, into a system where anything is permissible. It used to be that if you had a child out of wedlock, it was an absolute disgrace. And it used to be that now almost 45% of the children born in this country are born out of wedlock. And it used to be that you just never, ever, ever would live with somebody before you got married. And now the majority of young people live together prior to getting married. And so our value system has been degraded, and any society in the history of the world that's ever embraced a decline in morality and that has ever embraced and said it's okay to have homosexuality has declined and has fallen into utter decay. And the United States is now allowing homosexuals to preach from the pulpit, and they're being given rights, marital rights,
what?
And so forth and so on. Go ahead.
Are you there, Mike? What? Yeah. So what do you mean they're allowing homosexuals to preach from the pulpit? From what church?
There are churches out there, not many, but there are churches out there that have homosexual priests. I mean, not priests, pastors. So it depends
on
the congregation.
Churches. I mean, you know, we're talking about the major denominations.
But what I'm saying is that we're embracing things that we never embraced before. There are no moral absolutes anymore. You get a political group that gets together that's a minority that becomes very vocal, and all of a sudden they're out promoting rights for themselves. And it goes against the majority of the population, and all of a sudden a very vocal minority is in control, and that's what's happened with the gays and the lesbians. And so at any rate, it's just, I have nothing against them personally, it's just that it's another indication of the collapse of our society from a moralistic viewpoint, and we've become very permissive. And then probably one of the biggest things that most Americans don't even realize is pinnacle to the collapse of this country is that we've become greedy and self-seeking. And basically we all live, or many of us live beyond our means. I sold real estate in the Naperville market in Illinois for about 15 years. And I wrote a previous book that I wrote more for my real estate clients. But in that book, I coined a term. The term was called penny millionaires. And here's where it came from. And it signals an epidemic in this country. I would have clients who would come out and buy a million-dollar piece of property, million-dollar house. six bedrooms, 5,000, 6,000 square feet, 3-4 car garage. Have a Beamer sitting in the driveway, and maybe a Mercedes Benz. And I'd walk inside, and the halls would echo because there was no furniture. In the master bedroom,
yeah,
there'd be a mattress on the floor. There'd
I've
be card tables
like that.
They're penny millionaires. They might have put 10% down, $100,000, on a million-dollar property, and they're indebted and mortgaged up to their eyebrows. And so why do we have that? We have it because part of that degradation of our, of our morality, is that they have made us believe that who we are is to a very large degree defined by the kind of job we have, by the kind of car that we drive, by the kind of house that we live in, by the kind of neighborhood that we live in, by the place we send our schools to. And that was never the case back in pioneering America. People didn't look at materialism as being that important. We had neighbors, we had friends, we had community. And along with that, that self-seeking is what's happened is you're always in competition with somebody. You're trying to take something away from somebody else or compete with them for something. And so we've become a very divisive society, society of people who are estranged from one another. And there's no sense of continuity left within the American structure. And then the biggest problem here is that there's absolutely no understanding of the management of money, and basically we've become a very, very greedy society. And here's the place I want to make my first really important statement. I've been blessed in that as I wrote this book, God prepared me over a 30-year period, and I've been in virtually every position I need to be in order to write with authority on this book. And so the next statement I'm going to make is not a textbook statement, but it's a real-world situation that I've experienced. And that is that if we don't understand very soon that our greed is causing us to go bankrupt, we're going to be in trouble. You can't run a household and have negative cash flow every month and not eventually go broke. So look at what's happening within the country right now. Our leaders are telling us the way to get out of this is to spend more, to build more debt. But then what do? Well, we just had an increase in taxes in September in the state of Illinois, in the Chicagoland area, and there was a tax revolt in one suburb, Schaumburg, because their housing prices had fallen 30 to 40%, and yet their taxes went up about 20%. And in the state of Illinois, we're one of those wonderful industrialized states that have lost many, many, many tens of thousands of jobs, and we're literally bankrupt. So just this past week, we had a 75% increase in the state tax within this country, within this state. And so basically, they're telling us to spend, but at the same time, none of the money is being spent on anything productive. It's not being spent on jobs. It's not being spent on infrastructure. It's not being spent on anything to create manufacturing positions. It's all going out and creating more national debt. And as a result, nothing is coming in. And so the shortfalls are accumulating, and then the government turns around on top of telling us to spend, and they tax us into submission. And so that's basically what's happening. So what I'm getting at is that if we don't want to become China, we have to tighten our belts, each and every household out there. This is one of the real things we can do. Tighten your belts. Stop spending. Stop being extravagant. Live very, very, very much within your means, and try to pay off your debts. And I want to tell you what our government's pushing us towards. There's increasing talk coming out of the White House and out of Washington, D.C., that says that they see us emerging eventually into a state-run nation, and that is exactly what they have in China. And I've been to China and spent quite a bit of time there, so I basically want to paint you a picture of what life in China is like. And if we don't stop buying the free trade goods from China and running our national debt up, probably within the next few years, what exists in China today will begin to exist over here. And so in China, you don't have freedom of movement. Here, if we decide we want to take a new job and we want to move from Michigan to Florida, absolutely no problem. We can go anywhere we want to go within the continent of the United States, take any job we want to take, live anywhere we want to live, live within our means, and we've got, you know, some degree of freedom. Over there, typically, you have to go on a waiting list to get a home, an apartment, and generally you work in a factory someplace, and your place of employment is on the grounds where the factory is. Everything that you do relates to the job, and the government is the one that decides what is done within the economy. There's no free market system. It's a capitalist system, but it's not a free market system. What happens is the government says, we need to produce this product or that product, or we need to develop this infrastructure or whatever, and the government makes all the decisions, and the people basically work for very, very, very low salaries, tantamount to what we had in this country during the Industrial Revolution, which were sweatshops. And the dream in China is not to own a home. The dream is to own a car. And maybe a very small percentage dream about actually owning a home someday. But for most of them, it's the dream of having a car, because most of them don't have cars. And so that's the nation that we're likely to become if we keep listening to our government and keep spending, and spend ourselves into a debt. And then along with that, in order to condition us so that they can move us maybe in steps and increments, maybe the first step is we go into this state capitalist system, and certainly the final step is that they will push us over into a global economy, where eventually Europe and the United States and the entire free market system will collapse, and when that happens, they'll move us into a global economy. But to do that, here's what they've been doing. That's the second signal that I want to throw out to the American people that they need to be cognizant of. They've basically destroyed our pride and our national sovereignty. A couple of examples. There was a boy in the Midwest who rode a bicycle to school. About 3 months ago, and he was called into the principal's office and told that he had displayed a U.S. flag on the back of his bicycle, and that a complaint had been made, and he would no longer be allowed to do that, and they were taking the flag. His parents complained. It got some publicity, and the boy was able to display the flag. But since when is the display of the United States flag something to be ashamed of? Since Obama came into office.
This was in the United States.
This was in the United States of America. And that thinking...
What's wrong with displaying the United States flag in the United States of America?
Pardon me?
Who would complain about that?
Well...
That's crazy.
If you followed what Obama's done since he came into office, he refused to pledge allegiance to the flag. He didn't put his hand over his heart when the Pledge of Allegiance was going on. And you'll remember that there was a big controversy because he wouldn't wear the lapel pin, which was the flag.
Yeah, I remember that.
And you recall that he has said that his wife said that when he was elected, when Obama was elected, that was the first time in her life she'd ever been proud of America. So basically, he has been on record consistently, which means the policy of Washington has been on record as basically saying that the United States is a warmongering nation, and that nations around the world hate us, and there has been rhetoric coming out of Washington as to possibly changing the national anthem and possibly changing the flag of the United States of America because, quote, unquote, they are symbols of hatred and oppression. And so, you know, they have to basically degrade our national pride and our sense of being Americans if they're going to try to drive us into some kind of state-run society or some kind of global society. And so that's something else that they're doing to us. And so we need to basically get back in our churches. We need to reestablish our financial base. We need to reestablish our morality. And very importantly, we need to reestablish our contact with our families, because as women have gone to work, the family has degraded, and divorce has gone up to well over 50% now in this nation. And if we don't have a family unit, then you don't have a strong nation. And so we have to basically look, this is first things that we need to do, each and every one of us in every household, look to our households, look to our value, look to our Christian values, look to our nationalism, and look to our finances. Those are the things that we can do on a personal front, and then we'll get into things that we can do as a group, as a society, as we go through the conversation here tonight. And so basically, the other thing that we need to be cognizant of, and Mike, maybe you can chime in here on some of this. I'd kind of like
to
be a little conversational if we could. But basically, if we look at...
You're on a roll, dude. I'm not interrupting you right now. Go ahead.
if we look at what has happened in terms of the legislation coming out of Washington, I don't think this takes anybody who's been particularly active in politics. I'm trying to bring this to a level where whoever's listening out there in that listening audience right now, if this is the first time you're listening, you'll be able to understand what I'm saying. We've gone
and
to policy.
Everybody's welcome to call in and make comments and ask questions, by the way, too. So y'all listen and don't be shy to call in and add your two cents or ask questions. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Larry.
Good. That's good. I'm glad you said that. So basically what they've done is they've made us dependent on the state in an ever-increasing fashion. And so basically we've lost our financial solvency as family units and as states and as a government because we spent money that we didn't have. And so that increasingly makes us dependent because the ripple effect occurs. Basically, jobs are lost, less money is coming in, there's less taxes come in, taxes get raised, and eventually what happens is our standard of living drops and drops and drops. Foreclosures become, you know, rampant and epidemic, and everybody's standard of living starts to drop, and that's part of what they're trying to accomplish. In order to make this thing work, they have to degrade the standard of living of the United States of America, and so that's part of what they're doing. But let's look at the individual initiatives that we have seen since Obama came into office, and let's try to analyze them and say we are in a recession, we are probably really realistically in a depression, and if we really want to be honest, it's probably a depression that before it's over with will be as great or greater than the Great Depression of 1929. So in other words, we're on the brink of economic collapse. So what we should be doing...
I think we are in the position to do something about that, though. I don't think it has to be that way. And I agree with what you're saying about Obama and, you know, the pin, he wouldn't wear the American flag pin, he won't salute the flag and all this other stuff. And, you know, that's some of the stuff. And that was before he got elected. You know, a lot of that stuff was before he got elected.
Right.
And, you know, the fact that people still voted for him, you know, that kind of showed me that, it's not just Obama, it's the voters. And you know people, you know, they're kind of you know opening up to the fact that they might have made a mistake and they voted different here, you know, back in 2010 and even 2009. 2009 wasn't that big of an election, but 2010 was, and 2012 is going to be a really big election coming up here soon. But Obama, you know, I mean, I think people are—he's a great speech maker. He really is. I saw him on TV two nights ago with that memorial about what happened in Tucson, and yeah, he really is a great speech maker. But you know, aside from that, you know, I mean, I think people are really. You know, okay, we've had the first black president now. Okay, yay! And now it's time to actually take care of business again because. It's not getting done, and we're not in a worse predicament, but we're on the verge of being in a worse predicament than we were before Obama came into office. And yes, any president walking into that position in 2009, actually, January 2009, when he got inaugurated, anybody walking into that situation had a big job ahead of them. And I'm not faulting Obama for making mistakes, or you know, any president, you know, but... It's just the dismissiveness of his nature, his mentality of this is what's best for America and this is what I'm going to do. And, you know, that might sound great from one side, but if you think about it, he wasn't elected to do what he thinks is best for us, him or Nancy Pelosi, by the way. They weren't elected and put in that position, those positions, to do what they think is best for America. You know, they weren't elected to be your mom and dad. They were elected to represent us, to listen to American people and do what's in what they think is in their best interest, the American people.
Well, let's talk about why he was elected. I mean, his platform, if you look at the things that he said that he was going to have transparency in government. He's got one of the least transparent administrations that we've ever had. He said he was not going to have any lobbyists in his administration. There are 12 lobbyists, major key lobbyists that are in his administration. He said he wasn't going to raise taxes. Well, taxes hidden and real are being raised. So basically what happened is he said he was going to give America a fundamental transition. And
I've got a good one when you're
problem.
Done.
Okay, here's the problem. Americans weren't informed, and what Americans did is they listened naively to his rhetoric, and they didn't look at the bigger picture, and they did a knee-jerk reaction. There was a protest occurring against Bush and against the Bush policies, and so all they did is changed parties, and the American people moved from the Republicans to the Democrats, and now in the midterms we've moved from the Democrats to the Republicans, and this is basically what this show is about. We can't keep being that naive in the future. What we have to do is start to not listen to the rhetoric of the candidates, but we have to go backwards and look at what did that administration or the prior administration or that party actually do when they were in power. Did they do anything that represents what that individual candidate or that party is telling us they're going to do when they get in power in the future? And so what we have to do is we have to come up with candidates, which is what the last half of the show will be about, that have a plank that is in the best interest of turning this country around economically. So basically, let's maybe if we can, Mike, go into this so we have time left for the solutions. Let's discuss the individual political initiatives that have occurred under the Obama administration, and let's just be common sense individuals and say, does that individual piece of legislation fit with what we think we need to do to restore our economy? Does it reduce taxes? Because when taxes are reduced, there's truly more money available to be spent in the economy, which energizes the economy. Is the money that was spent from the stimulus, was it spent to build permanent jobs? Did it build factories? And did it make jobs that was going to make America stronger in the future? Did we invest in new technologies? And the answer to all of those questions are no. So cap and
right.
trade. That's the
and
first
before we move on,
okay?
Before we move on to that, because this is just something that, you know, I was thinking about where you were talking a few minutes ago about all the things Obama said, and you know, you were going down the list, and I said I got a good one. Before we move on,
okay.
Do you remember when he said we're not going to spend money that we don't have? And then a year later,
yes, I remember that.
We're not going to spend money we don't have, and he held by that statement, because what he did was he wanted how many trillions of dollars more, which only deflated the value of the dollar, which only causes inflation. But he didn't spend money we don't have. He just went in his office and printed more of it. Is that a solution?
Well, what he did is he made us indentured servants, and that really is, now you're on one of my really hot points, and I wasn't going to talk about
I was trying to get that out before we went into the next topic or subtopic there, but yeah, when you were saying that stuff, that was in my mind. I was like, I got to say that before we move on, but
no, he did. I mean, we not only had the stimulus, which basically I want to comment on.
Oh yeah,
again, I want to ask
one
people.
Thing real quick.
Okay.
Also about spending money. Spending money into the economy builds jobs and, you know, creates jobs, and the more jobs that people have, the more money they spend, and you know, it builds the economy. Yes, it does. But what you were talking about earlier about getting into debt, no, that's not the way to do that. We're saying spend money, you know, into the economy. We're not saying to go in debt doing it. And what else? Oh, you mentioned about houses. You know, people have these million-dollar houses, the BMWs parked out front, and you go inside and there's hardly any furniture. Yes, I've been to homes like that. And it didn't dawn on me that they were, you know, up to their ears in mortgage, which is why they didn't have very nice furniture, or very much furniture, I should say. What they did have was nice, but there was a big living room and a fireplace and one chair and a rug and a coffee table and, you know, that was maybe a bookcase. And, of course, a big screen TV, you know, plasma screen TV. But the thing was, it wasn't a homey feeling. Like, you know, you can walk into a middle-class home, and there's pictures of the wall, you know, pictures on the walls from generations back, and, you know, it's just a homey feeling when you go into most people's houses, and these new big houses, they don't feel like that. Some of them do, you know, but, you know, a lot of them, they don't have... I don't know, a lot of them don't even have carpeting, and like you said, you walk through and you hear an echo and stuff like that, and it's just not a homey feeling. And I've been to houses in really poor neighborhoods that look like they're dilapidated from the outside, and you go in, and they're really nice inside. Might not be nice as far as fancy rich, but, you know, just nice, homey, clean, you know, pictures on the wall. You can go in there and see, you know, people's memories on the wall and stuff like that. And, you can't help but ask, hey, who's this in that picture and where was this taken at? And you see their knickknacks, and there's a story behind everything in most people's homes. You know, it's not
just about the
parked outside.
Let me make a comment on that because sure. You really hit on something more important than the listening audience might think. There was a book that was written several years ago called I think it's called The Millionaire Next Door. I think that's the name of it. Anyway, here's the bottom line. As I went into middle-class homes, as you're saying, Mike, what I found was that, no, things weren't always new. Sometimes they were old. Sometimes they were shabby. But those people were living within their means. They had a nucleus family around them. They had core values that they believed in. And they were still living, to a very large degree, the way, according to the foundation of this country and the principles, what happens in those big houses that are empty and full of that have no furniture is that the primary breadwinner is out on the road 4 or 5 days a week, or he's going to the corporate office and doesn't get home until 8 or 9 o'clock at night. The mother is working. The child is with a nanny. And basically there's absolutely no heritage there because they've sold their souls and repeatedly over and over and over again, you know, America has lost sight of what is truly important. If you don't have friends, if you don't have family, if you don't have a sense of community, you don't have anything. And that's what they're systematically, intentionally, with intent, taking away. For example, in terms of women going to work, I almost had a fight with a lady on an interview on this subject a few weeks ago, so I'll be careful. So any of you people, ladies out there who are women livers, please take this with a grain of salt, because I know that if you joined that movement, you joined because you wanted to have equal rights for women, you wanted to have women have fair salaries, and there were, you know, certain things that you believed in. But what you probably didn't know was that many organizations such as that have very important belief systems that people believe in and will get behind can be used and manipulated. And so in that instance, the Rockefeller Foundation poured a lot of money into the Women's Lib organization when it was really, really, really a big movement. And the reason they did it, I mean, they basically went out in some of their documents and said it. We wanted to get women to work. We wanted to get control of the children sooner, get them into daycare, because if we can control the minds of the children, we control the next generation. If we can degrade the family, then we can control the society. And so that's what we're getting at. But let's get back, if we can, to the
Before we move on back and forth, either way, let me comment on what you just said about that, because not only does it affect family fundamentals, but it also affects it has a major effect on the economy, economics, and, you know, because by okay, you know, let me put out the same disclaimer you did. I have nothing against women working. I have nothing against women getting careers and, you know, doing whatever, okay? But I believe they should be able to do that because they want to, not because they have to support, you know, bring in half the income to support the family because they have to. I believe they should have the option to stay home and be housewives and cook and clean. Not as an option, okay, ladies? Yeah, oh, look at the lines lighting up. I'm just kidding. But no, they should have the option. It should be an option. But when, you know, with the Women's Lib movement, that was back in the 70s, I believe. But before that Women's Liberation movement, you know, burning the bras and all that stuff, you know, it was like the man went out and worked, And he brought home enough money, you know, bring home the bacon and all that. But, you know, what I'm saying economically is he brought home enough money to pay the mortgage on the house, to furnish the house, to put groceries in the house, to put the kids in school, to put the kids in clothes and send them to school. You know, dinner was on the table every night, you know, and the wife stayed home and took care of the house, which was the basic of the family fundamentals. So economically.
And our kids had values.
Right, exactly. So we had the economic side where only one member of the family had to go out and provide the major income, and the other member of the family stayed home and took care of the family fundamentals. Okay, now when you introduced basically twice as many people into the workforce, okay, well, it's supply and demand. You know, we're talking about economics and we're talking about jobs, but it's still supply and demand. There's a certain amount of jobs out there that have to be filled. If there's not enough people to fill them, people are going to, you know, businesses, they're going to offer higher salaries. They're going to offer better benefits. They're going to try to get people to take those jobs. And when you introduce twice as many people into the workforce, then there's more people looking for jobs than there are jobs, so the companies offer less money. They offer less benefits. And you see how that all pans out?
That's a component, but there's also another, even more sinister component.
It's
a valid. And the other component of it goes all the way back to 1913 when the Federal Reserve was founded. And at that point, they took us off the gold standard, and they introduced intentionally inflation and devaluation into our currency because that was the way to control us. So in terms of the comment that you made, Mike, what they intentionally did was through devaluation of our dollar, they put the American family into a position where most Americans didn't have a choice as to whether or not the wife went to work or not. And so that was all intentional in order to economically collapse us as a nation and to morally collapse us by destroying the family. So to give you an example, you can go on the web and you can type in, I think it's inflation calculator, and I put in $1 in the year 1913, and then I put in the year 2011, and it gives you a calculation for what that dollar is worth today. So a 1913 dollar is worth $21.10. That's the equivalent. That is a 2,110% inflation rate. And so
that's 200 times what, yeah. Because, yeah. See, okay, I don't want to sound like my granddad here. You know, nothing wrong with my granddad, but, I remember when I was a little kid going, oh, my God, a candy bar is 25 cents. I used to get that for a nickel. Well, look, I went to a 7-Eleven the other day, and I don't eat a lot of candy, you know, because I got a high metabolism. I eat sugar, you know, my blood sugar skyrockets, and I forget to eat something, and I feel like crap later. I guess stay away from sweets for the most part. But I haven't had a candy bar in a while, and I like Reese's Cups and stuff, and they come up with a Snickers peanut butter thing, and I was like, hey, that actually looks good. But do you know how much a candy bar sells for to 7-Eleven these days? I'm telling you. How much?
Probably close to
$2. How much did you say, Larry?
$2.
It's over a dollar. They were on sale for two candy bars for $2. What was the sale price for a regular candy bar? And I was going, wait a second. Now, I mean, it's been a while since I bought a candy bar, but I'm walking around the 7-Eleven sounding like my granddad going, good Lord, I remember I could get a candy bar for 50 cents.
Well, you know, this will put it in perspective in terms of our loss of real dollars. And not only do we have,
you
know,
the dollars.
How do kids
afford to go to 7-Eleven to get a candy bar anymore? I mean, you know,
well,
I
took my son to the show the other day, and I'm in my 60s. When I used to go to the show as a child, I could go to the show, have a small bag of popcorn and a small soda for 50 cents. I took my son to see a show the other day. We got two medium sodas, two small popcorns, and the total bill for the ticket and the beverages was $50.50. So what used to cost 50 cents cost $50. And so with that, you can see that they've degraded us to where what happens is that's why we have to become dependent on the government, because people can't save. They've lost the ability to save money because of what they've done to hurt our economy. And so every time we turn around, they make us more and more and more dependent. And that's one of the ways they divide us. They divide us by basically pitting us against one another for ever increasingly scarcer and scarcer resources. And as they do that and as they degrade our morality, they basically put us in a situation where they can take us over. Because if they can make us dependent on them or think we're dependent on them, then they can literally do anything they want to do, and then they believe we'll just stand back and do nothing. So if it's okay, can we go on and talk about the legislation that they've imposed on us, and then we'll get into some of the solutions real quick?
Yeah, let's do that. We've got 20 minutes left. So, well, in the regular show, we can go on if you want to.
Cap and trade, basically, as Obama said, under his program, energy costs would of necessity skyrocket. Well, it's not just energy cost. It's food cost, and every single product that's manufactured has a carbon footprint. So it means that every single solitary consumer good that we buy will go up. So basically, cap and trade has no technological solution in order to realistically lower CO2. And the government, I have quotes in my book that says that whether or not there's any science to cap and trade or not, that the legislators will support it because they want it, and basically it is the largest tax increase that has ever been imposed on a society in the history of modern times. And then we move on to health care. And again,
before we move on to health care, cap and trade, we hear that term a lot, but what exactly is cap and trade?
Okay, cap and trade is a piece of legislation that the Obama administration is trying to get through. They probably will not successfully get it through now because of the change of power that happened in the midterm election, but they can use the Federal Trade Commission, and they can also use the new financial reform bill in order to get many of the same things through. Here's what it is. Basically, they're saying that we have CO2 pollution in the air, and that is causing global warming, which is scientifically, I could spend a whole hour on that alone. It is scientific.
Just in brief, so people who hear the term cap and trade all the time, and they go, well, cap and trade, is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? What is that thing?
The government is saying that we have to reduce the amount of carbon emissions. And so what they're going to do is they're going to put a cap on the amount of CO2 emissions that can be emitted in the atmosphere by manufacturing corporations, and then trade, they will have certificates, and those manufacturing organizations that can produce goods below their ceiling can then trade their certificates to another organization that has need of them. And so basically they'll cap the ceiling, and then those that are under the ceiling will be able to trade their certificates. And what it's going to do is it's going to be very reminiscent of what happened with Enron and the energy debacle in California. It will create a highly speculative situation where those CO2 certificates can be traded, and but what it's really going to do is it's going to drive up the cost of everything. But the real scientific community says it will have absolutely no impact on CO2, because the global warming that we're seeing, the real science says that it's cyclical. It coincides with other periods that we've had in history where we have a major amount of sunspots happening, and they say that the thing you need to look at in order to understand that is if it was just endemic to this planet, then this planet would have increases in temperature, but all the other planets in our solar system would not. But what the scientists say is that you can look at all of the planets in our solar system, and they're all having similar changes, therefore pointing to the fact that it's sunspot activity and not CO2 emissions that's causing the problem. So it's a bogus piece of legislation that's out there that's just designed to basically drive up the cost of energy and of every single solitary commodity we have so that they can control us. It's all about controlling us. And then we move on to the next piece, which is healthcare. And I happen to have been fortunate enough to have worked for Atomic Energy of Canada and spent quite a bit of time not only in China, as we talked about a minute ago, but in Canada. And I saw people literally die while they were waiting to have surgeries and die while they were waiting to have diagnostic treatments done. And all that does is that captures one-sixth of the GDP of this country, and it has already driven up insurance costs. And they've gone and done exactly the opposite of what they said they'd do. They said the whole intent of it was, if you remember, Mike, that every American would have insurance. Wasn't that the big pitch?
Well, did they put health care insurance, or did they put it, it would come from the government? Like if they couldn't get it through a private, like if they, okay, if their job didn't give them health benefits and they couldn't get insurance on their own, then they could get government insurance. But they had to sign up.
You had to buy insurance. If you didn't buy insurance, you were fined. So we've never had a situation. They did it under the Federal Trade Commission.
My point is you had to register with the government to either prove that you had health care through your job, you had health care individually that you paid for yourself, or, you, of course, if you're going to get insurance through the government, health coverage through the government, whether you call it insurance or not, that's kind of semantics there, semantical. But either way, you had to register with the government to prove that you had to have that you had either insurance through your job through individually, or you had to register with the government through them. And, yes, if you didn't do any of those three, you could get a fine. But that's another way – I saw it as another way of Big Brother trying to step into your business, knowing your income and everything else you do.
Absolutely.
And, you know,
it's all about control,
so,
Mike. Financial control is control of our data.
Right. So, it's a backup to the IRS getting in your business is what it is. I mean, yeah, pay your taxes. I'm not saying not, because, you know, without taxes, we don't have defense. We don't have nothing. We don't have roads, schools, nothing like that. I'm not saying don't pay your taxes, but the IRS, was it you we were talking with the other night? You said the IRS, it's actually illegal what they do. Was it you who said when you sign a W-2, you're actually volunteering to pay taxes? You don't have to pay taxes.
The federal income tax is an illegal tax. They passed the 16th Amendment, hoping that it would give them the right to tax our income. But the Supreme Court in six separate decisions came back and said, no, it's not legal. And so basically they did an end run around it. And when you take a job and you get your 1040, then that is you volunteering to pay a tax. But basically, we're getting off topic.
But we
got to
pay taxes, because without taxes, we don't have government.
Not that particular tax, Mike, because here's the point.
Right. The military.
That funding comes primarily from corporate tax, which is legal. And the other functions that are provided by the federal government, Homeland Security, and all the things that they take care of, those basically come out of excise taxes, which are point-of-sale taxes. But here's the point. That was a whole separate show before. But basically, if you're listening at home, go pull one of your tax records after the show is over, turn your check over, and you'll see that you made out a check to the Internal Revenue Service, which is the National Treasury Department, but on the back, it's endorsed by the Federal Reserve, which is a privately owned conglomerate of banks, international bankers. And so the point is that nothing, not one penny of the money that we pay in federal income tax goes for any services for the citizenry of the United States of America. All of that money goes to pay the interest on the trillions of dollars that are of counterfeit money that is issued by the Federal Reserve, private banking institutions that we have to pay interest on. That, and that alone, is what your federal income tax is used for. And so that's a whole other conversation. But basically, we have to, at some point down the road, once we gain some more control, we have to go back and we have to get rid of the Federal Reserve. Andrew Jackson fought, and he said basically that the biggest accomplishment of his presidency was when he got rid of the Federal Reserve that preceded this one, the Second Central Bank of the United States. And I think you can build a fairly credible case that says a part of the reason that Kennedy was assassinated was because he had signed an executive order 11110, and had he lived and had it gone into effect, it would have done two very, very important things. It would have significantly limited the power of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, and it would have completely dismantled the Federal Reserve. We would have paid the Federal Reserve their money back, and then the issuance of currency would have gone back, as our founding fathers wanted it to, back to the Treasury, so that when the Treasury issued currency, there is no indebtedness in the form of interest payments that accrue. So now we have to get rid of that. So that's, in a way, it was good that you brought it out, Mike, because it's another one of the ways in which they make us dependent on them. And then you've got the financial reform bill. And so, folks, just ask yourself this question. When you're in a depression, shouldn't you be doing everything you can do to stimulate the flow of money into the market? And in particular, shouldn't you be doing everything you can to make a capital investment attractive so that corporations and particularly entrepreneurial firms can go out and invest and grow their businesses and hire people? Well, what the financial reform bill did is it put power in the hands of a bureaucracy that can use the Federal Trade Commission and can use their bureaucratic powers to pass hundreds and hundreds of even thousands of bureaucratic regulations that will impose onerous regulations on corporations around the United States of America, making them non-competitive in the world market. And so there's another example of where a major piece of legislation that they tell us is good for us is actually degrading our society and driving us deeper and deeper and deeper into debt. So you've got cap and trade, you've got the illegal income tax, you've got the healthcare program, you've got the financial reform bill, none of which stimulated our economy and all of which degraded it. And then let's go backwards, and the last one was the stimulus. And I want you to basically think about this, folks. That whole crisis lasted less than 2 weeks, and in 2 weeks they had a 2,300-page bill.
You're including the bailouts, right? When you say the stimulus, you're talking about the bailouts as well, correct?
Yeah, $740 billion that was in the first stimulus. Then you got, of course, the QE2. But basically, what I want people to stop and think about was everything is planned and intentional. Don't think for one second that any bank of lawyers or any bank of politicians wrote a 2,300-page bill in 2 weeks. That bill was written probably over a two-year period. The whole collapse was staged. It occurred at a pivotal point in time, right between elections, and basically it was designed to help drive us further into economic collapse. So to sum it all up,
just like they didn't write the Homeland Security Act 2 days before 9/11 happened. Yeah, the Homeland Security Act, you know, all that. What was that based on? Do you know, Larry? I can't think of it. But yeah,
I think you're talking about the Patriot Act and what happened.
The Patriot Act, yes, sir. There you
is,
go. Prior to 9/11.
This is again a whole chapter in my book and something we could talk about for an hour, but basically, several months before 9/11, we distributed troops around all over the country. So you don't deploy troops around the world unless you've got plans. And there's in my book there's information talking about how they had a plan for accomplishing the toppling of governments that were not friendly to the United States, i.e. Iraq and Afghanistan, how they were talking about having permanent bases in the Middle East, and how they were talking about increasing funding to the military. All three of those things were accomplished as a result of 9/11. And so all of that was already pre-planned. But what happened, what you're talking about specifically, Mike, is that the legislators got together, and for one of the first times in history, they passed a bill that represented both the Republicans and Democrats getting together in bipartisan form and passing the Patriot Act. What happened is that 3:45 in the morning, the day before the Patriot Act was passed, another huge bill, President Bush, pulled that, and he replaced it with a White House version written by his staff, and it contained powers that the legislator had previously said, we don't want these powers. We don't want these things happening. they lead us towards martial law. They give too much power. And so what happened is they went in and they twisted their arms and they forced them to sign a bill that they had never seen, never had any discussions on, and had no idea what was in it. And that is that, in concert with a few other things they've done, the million-man army that Obama asked for. Here's another thing most people don't know. In the stimulus, they not only hijacked the student loan program, but that campaign request that he was making during his election campaign, where he was saying we need to have a homeland security system as strong as our national military, basically that was provided for in the stimulus package. And so with that, now you have to go all the way back to Hitler, and you see that what you've done is now you've created something that our founding fathers never wanted, which was the mechanism to have a domestic army on U.S. soil, and that army then can be used to control us and to drive us into martial law. Well, before we lose time, we really never – well, actually, you know what, Mike? We're going to have to take this whole other topic at another time. It's 5 minutes till, and we never did get into what the American people can do
And that's important. That is very important. What can we do, Larry?
So we're going to have to – I mean, that's a whole hour in itself. I will leave you with one thought, though, because there is something right now today that I can signal you to. So basically, as far as we got tonight, I'll kind of recap. The first things we have to do is take personal ownership in our problems. We can't go out next in 2012 and make another knee-jerk reaction at the polls and just move – you know, repeatedly back and forth from Republican to Democrat, Democrat to Republic to ad nauseum. We have to basically understand, which is what maybe we should talk about next week because we didn't get to it, is what political platform do we need in order to turn this country around? So we'll talk about that next week. But right now, what we did get through is we've got personal responsibilities. We need to basically, as a family, start going to church, start to pray to God, start to change our values, start to become Americans, develop some patriotism, start to live within our means. And right now there is a political action that each and every person out there listening needs to take. Right now there is a petition being passed around by the Republican Party. It may not be effective, but we need to get involved. They're calling for a petition to be signed. They need at least 10 million Americans to step to the plate, and the petition is to repeal the health care program. And so
yes,
anybody
I've seen
who's
that on
out
TV.
There,
there's a TV commercial
need,
about it, and I've already signed
need
it on
to get
Facebook.
Involved. Yep, you
yes,
need
I,
to get
I've
involved,
also
folks.
Seen it on Facebook. I signed it. Do you by any chance know the website address for that?
No,
if
I don't.
Not,
I
can look it up.
I should have taken it down. Okay, if you post
yeah,
it, that'd
I should have it's on TV. It's on Facebook. It's called Repeal the Healthcare Bill Now or something.com. And I'm sure it's not hard to find. It's all over Facebook. I signed it on Facebook. You'll see my name on there. Search for Michael Hammer in the list of names. You'll see it. I signed it months ago. And you'll see the information on TV and stuff like that. Yeah, that's very important.
And then next week, I'll kind of give you an idea of what we really didn't get into today. Here's what we'll be talking about in terms of beyond the personal, what can you do on the political? Well, sign this petition for openers, and then we'll be talking next week about specifics relating to election reform, to finance reform, to trade reform, to health care reform, energy reform, pharmaceutical and drug reform, and then issues relating to our national sovereignty. And basically there's some legislations, HCR 40, which we'll talk about, which resolves that we don't want to be a part of the North American Union with China and with Canada and Mexico. And then we'll talk about a whole host of bills that have been passed and executive orders that have been passed that encroach upon our civil liberties. And so what the American people need to know is not only the kind of things that we need to put together in the future in terms of new legislation, but we need to be going back and we need to know the specific pieces of legislation, just like the health care reform bill, that we need to get out of Washington, basically get repealed, And then we have to have a basic understanding of what we're going to replace them with. And so that's why we need to have this conversation about what plank is it that is not going to degrade the financial stability of this nation like the current Obama administration plank is doing. But what plank are we going to have if we're going to have a financial turnaround and if we're going to save this nation? And so that will be the topic of next week's conversation.
Sounds awesome.
And I guess with that, Mike, according to my watch, it's 7 o'clock.
You know what? On the dot. Larry, that was an awesome job, sir. And, with Dolly not being here, I mean, it was like, I don't really know how to... I got the thing in my ear going 10 seconds, but I really don't know how to moderate the way she does and keep things going. But you did an awesome job. Just great. A lot of information, a lot of valuable information, and next week we'll continue it with the other topics. And everybody, Larry Ballard, he's an author. He's got a website. You can find him at libertycrusade.com. You can find his book on amazon.com. He's got several books. One of them is Modern Slavery and the Fight for Freedom. And great job, Larry. I can't say that enough. I mean, a lot of information. And I'm going to have to listen to this hour back 3 times just to really absorb it. I'm listening going, wow, this stuff is blowing my mind. So we'll see you back next Friday night.
Thank you very much, and I'll see you Friday at 6. Take care.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Everybody. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Larry Ballard. Great job. We'll see you next week. Peace. God bless, everybody. This is MJH, and I'm out of here. Later.
You have been listening to the MJH Experience on Blog Talk Radio.
Produced by CommunicationCreations.com.